This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
In 1997, a classic book about the psychology of racism was published called Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria and Other Conversations About Race? Now that book has been updated and re-released as a 20th anniversary edition, and it seems as fresh today as the day it was first published.
20 years later, we still need that conversation. We still need to move beyond our fear, our anger, our denial.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, a conversation with Dr. Beverly Daniel Tatum about the update of her book on race and education in the U.S. Plus, we'll spend an academic minute getting an update on the refugee crisis, going all the way back to 400 B.C. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Walk into any racially mixed high school and you'll see black and white and Latino youth all clustered together in their own groups. Is this self-segregation a problem to address or just a coping strategy? Beverly Daniel Tatum, a renowned authority on the psychology of racism, argues that straight talk about our racial identities is essential if we're serious about enabling communication across racial and ethnic divides. These topics have only become more urgent as the national conversation about race is increasingly acrimonious. Dr. Beverly Daniel Tatum is President Emerita of Spelman College and in 2014 received the Award for Outstanding Lifetime Contribution to Psychology, the highest honor presented by the American Psychological Association. She spoke about the 20th anniversary edition of her book, Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria and Other Conversations About Race, with The Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue, about why a 20th anniversary edition is needed and why it's as relevant today as it was 20 years ago.
One of the things that I can say is that 20 years ago, when I was writing my book, my goal was to help others move beyond fear, anger, and denial to a new understanding of what racism is, how it impacts all of us, and ultimately what we can do about it. And I would say 20 years later, we still need that conversation. We still need to move beyond our fear, our anger, our denial to have a productive conversation so we can make progress in our society. I know that there was a moment, perhaps after President Obama's election in 2008, when many people began to talk about America as a post-racial society. I think today, following recent history, most people would say, well, we still have these issues to talk about, and certainly I feel that way. But in the new version of my book, what I've tried to do is really talk about what's happened in the last 20 years and put it in a context as it impacts race relations. For example, 20 years later, our population is much more diverse. The demography of the nation has changed. But we still have persistent school and neighborhood segregation, which means that young people today still are not really learning in the ways that we need them to engage with one another across lines of difference.
What is it about that segregation? How does that occur? And this understanding of just what the question that the title asks, why are all the black kids sitting together in the cafeteria? Why does that happen? Because I'm guessing, and in reading of the book, the core reason for why that happens really has not changed over the last two decades.
I would agree that if, you know, as I like to say, the answer in some ways to the question is the same. However, relative to the book, there's been 20 years of research and understanding, deeper understanding of how social interactions around race take place, and I've tried to share that with the readers. But to begin just, you know, in a very simplistic way, to talk about how black kids, why they sit together in the cafeteria in adolescence, and I think that's important to say because if you walk into a racially mixed elementary school, you're not likely to see that kind of breakdown. But as young people become more conscious of their own sense of identity, that's typically a process that intensifies in adolescence, you can find black kids, as well as other marginalized kids, Latinos, Asians, Natives, Muslims, LGBTQ kids, kids who are often seen as outside the mainstream, often come together because it serves as a buffer, in the case of black kids, against racism. But it's also an affirmation of identity at a time when that's very important. But the question I always ask when I enter a school and someone asks me, why are the black kids or any other group of kids sitting together? The question that I ask is not just what's happening in the cafeteria, but what's happening in the classroom. How are teachers or school leaders helping kids navigate difference because they aren't growing up typically in the same neighborhoods? They're coming from different places, and there's so much in our society that encourages the reinforcement of stereotypes, which even when people want to make connections, sometimes those connections are derailed by awkward interactions and unconscious bias, particularly at the college level, which is often when young people come together in the most diverse learning environments they've ever experienced. How do we as school leaders create spaces for those kids to have the kind of support they need to make meaningful connections?
You talk about, on the subject of identity development, you talk about in the book that this, using examples of the use of Native American mascots and the model Asian minority myth, or growing up Muslim post 9/11, of how that has impacted the development, the identity development of these minorities.
Well, let me just start out by saying that in a race-conscious society, we all have a racial identity. Whether you identify as white or as a person of color or as a religious minority, everyone has multiple dimensions to their identity. We can describe ourselves in terms of our gender, in terms of our race, in terms of our religion or our socioeconomic background. But one of the things that is important is that how we think about those identities is really the result of social interaction. You know, if I think of myself as a smart person, it's because people in my life have told me that I am. If I think of myself as someone who is talented in music, it's because people have given me that feedback. I'm using these as examples, right? I'm not particularly talented in music. But the fact of the matter is that when young people are coming into their adolescence, that's a time when everyone, regardless of race, is thinking about, who am I? Who will I be in the world? How do other people see me? And so those questions of who we are and how others think about us is, in a race-conscious society, shaping other people's racial attitudes, is helping to shape how we see ourselves. So, you know, when we talk about racial identity, it's important to say that everybody has one. But let's imagine if you're a white person growing up in a mostly white neighborhood, going to a mostly white school, or working in a mostly white work setting. Your whiteness is not something that you're necessarily focused on, because that's not what other people are focused on. If you have some other characteristic that causes you to stand out, maybe you're white but you're in a wheelchair. Maybe it's your identity as someone who has a physical disability that is the identity that you're most focused on. But whatever it is, it's being brought to your attention by the people around you, by the way they're responding to you. And that's part of what young people are navigating, trying to figure out, what does this aspect of my identity mean, not in my own eyes only, but in the eyes of other people as well.
What do you think adults are doing correctly and not doing in helping those young people navigate the waters?
I think the thing that most adults are not doing is talking about it. And what they should do is engage in conversation. But a lot of people avoid conversations related to race or racism because they're afraid those conversations will become volatile, or maybe they'll say the wrong thing, or maybe they'll offend someone unintentionally. I have had many conversations with parents and teachers who say, you know, I know these are important conversations, but I don't know how to get started. And that is one of the things that I've tried to give guidance about in the book, to give examples of conversations I've had with my own children, as well as examples of educators who are doing a good job of bringing that dialogue into the classroom.
You write in the book about the multiracial baby boom that we have seen over the past two decades, and the last 20 years since the first edition of your book was put out, and the identity development of biracial youth, which is really fascinating to look at in and of itself.
Absolutely. One of the things that we know is that this population has grown from what was about 1 or 2% 20 or 30 years ago to about 10% of the population today. of school-age children, and how those children are thinking about themselves, how they come to identify themselves, is also shifting. I read with interest a recent story about the tennis player Madison Keys, and one of the comments about her was that she does not like to describe herself as either black or white. She is biracial, and she likes to say, "I'm just Madison." And I was reading people's comments about that, and what I thought about was, well, this is exactly the kind of research that is reflected in my book on the chapter on multiracial identity, because she's not alone. There are quite a number of young people growing up today who are changing how the world defines them, or at least how they're defining themselves, not following necessarily the one-drop rule that we used to talk about in sociology. And so I think as we think about the growing multiracial population, some of the definitions we've used in our society are going to shift.
Still to come, Joe Donahue's conversation with Dr. Beverly Daniel Tatum continues with a look at the identity of immigrants and the Dreamers. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Dr. Beverly Daniel Tatum, President Emerita of Spelman College. She spoke about the 20th anniversary edition of her book, Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria? And Other Conversations About Race, with The Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue.
You write in a chapter entitled Critical Issues in Identity Development, and you're writing about DACA. And you say that it's easy to feel sympathy for the young people caught in this undocumented dilemma and to lament the potential loss of human capital for a nation in need of talent. Yet what is the role of racism in this narrative? Realizing that this narrative is still being written, how do you look at it at this point?
How we think about immigration has changed over the years. When the major influx of white European immigration was taking place in the early part of the 20th century, in the first half of the 20th century, let's say, there were people who came without documentation. We know that. History tells us that. And the process by which they were able to work through those legal issues and become citizens was a much easier process than what we see today. Did that have to do with the fact that those immigrants were white? I can't say definitively that it was the reason, but I do know that the language that we use to describe immigrants that are coming from countries where the populations are of color, whether those are Latin American or Asian American or from the continent of Africa, the narrative, the words we use and how we talk about those immigrants is different and more consistent with the kind of stereotypical images we often find when we talk about race.
So as we as a nation right now are having the discussion about DACA, are having that discussion as to what Congress should do, where we should go, and the inconsistencies in what the president has said, what do you think we should be mindful of in having this conversation?
I think we should certainly be mindful of the psychological. I mean, I'm a psychologist, right? So I tend to look at things through a psychological lens. Economists will talk about it from an economic impact. Religious people might talk about it from a moral and spiritual concept. But I think about the psychological impact of children who are born here as citizens and yet may have undocumented family members, worrying about the loss of those parents on whom they depend. Thinking about young people who came as small children, some of whom may not have even known they were undocumented until they were in their adulthood or late adolescence. You know, you could certainly have grown up your whole life not knowing you were undocumented until you needed something like a driver's license or a Social Security card and realized that you couldn't get one. So when we think about the psychological impact on families, on young people through no fault of their own who find themselves in this very difficult situation, I think we need to have some compassion.
Let's say the program is suspended. Do you worry about what the long-term effect will have not only on those immediately impacted, but just on the overall discussions and as far as how we look at, quote-unquote, the other? My concern being, of course, that there is a domino effect then.
Well, certainly one of the things that I think is important when we talk about human nature is that we tend to think in us-them categories, right? It's part of how we move through the world. We categorize furniture, we categorize cars, we also categorize people. Our brains are designed to categorize. But we look to the leaders to help us know who is in and who is out. So our tendency to think in us-them categories is innate, but we also look to our environment to help us know who is the us and who is the them. And so we live in a society where it is possible for leaders to define who belongs in our circle very broadly. And when the leaders, and by leaders I don't mean just, you know, national leaders, the leader could be the school principal, the mayor of a town, the leader could be the head of a church. We all have a role to play in exercising this kind of leadership, but when leaders define the circle of membership in a very broad way, we tend to be more inclusive ourselves. We tend to follow that leader. When leaders define who belongs in our circle very narrowly, it does tend to create that sense of other. And the more narrowly that circle is drawn, the more people outside of it are made to feel vulnerable, if not actually become vulnerable. I saw a horrible story, which you may have seen, about a young 8-year-old biracial boy who was attacked by some teenagers who he thought were his friends.
Yes.
And hung him by a noose. He's lucky to be alive. And I thought to myself, what kind of education have those young people had, either at home or in their community, that would lead them to otherize that young boy in such a horrible way? We have to think about how we are drawing our circles all the time, what kind of example we're setting, and who's paying attention to us.
So what makes so much of our culture, as we draw those circles narrower and narrower, and we see where a great segment of our society, meaning enough people to have elected someone to be president of the United States, then what do we do for the rest of us who find that deplorable?
I think one of the things that I want to say in response to your question is that I want to underscore something I said actually in the previous question, which is that each of us can be a leader, right? We all have the opportunity to use our spheres of influence to change the narrative. So, you know, everyone influences someone, whether that's someone in their family, someone in their school, someone in their workplace, someone in their club or membership association. You know, we all have spheres of influence. And while it is easy sometimes to sit back and say, it's, you know, that person's responsibility to change the tone, each of us has a role to play in that. And I think one of the things I tried to emphasize in my book, in the earlier version and certainly in this one as well, in fact, the epilogue of my book is called Signs of Hope, Sites of Progress. I tried to lift up in that epilogue examples of individuals, ordinary people, who are making the choice to use their sphere of influence in a way that puts us back on a positive trajectory.
I actually was going to ask you next about the epilogue and where right now you see those signs of hope.
One of the places I mention very specifically is the University of Michigan. And I mention Michigan because it is the home of something called intergroup dialogue. And this is where young people are brought together across lines of difference to really engage in meaningful and sustained dialogue. Michigan is not the only place where that is happening. In fact, today I'm at Cornell University, and I was pleased to hear they have an intergroup dialogue program here at Cornell, and there are other places around the country. But I lift up dialogue as a strategy because so many people are living in circumstances where they don't really have a chance to engage in a meaningful way with people whose life circumstances are different from their own. And to the extent that colleges and universities can be intentional in creating those kinds of opportunities for dialogue, I think research shows, as a matter of fact, that young people who have participated in such programs are much more likely to lead more diverse lives, work in more diverse settings, live in more diverse communities, and have attitudes that help break down some of the barriers we see today, the racial divides we see today. Of course, not all of those conversations have to happen in colleges and universities, and I point to some other examples. But I think, for me, dialogue is a very important step, because when you really engage with someone else and come to understand what their experience is, and of course you want the same for yourself, when you have those conversations, I find that they motivate people to take action. And in the end, it's action that will make the difference.
Again, the name of Dr. Beverly Daniel Tatum's book is Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria and Other Conversations About Race? She spoke about the revised 20th anniversary edition of the book with the Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue. There is a continuing worldwide refugee crisis that's been going on pretty much forever. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
The refugee crisis is ongoing. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Robert Garland, professor of the classics at Colgate University, examines a past refugee crisis and connects it to our present.
Right now, there are over 60,000 refugees stranded in Greece. Many are encamped on islands like Lesbos and Chios, where they lack vital services. An unprecedented crisis? Hardly. Thousands flee as Xerxes advances into southern Greece, screamed the headline of a Greek newspaper in 480 BCE, or would have done, had there been newspapers back then when the Persians invaded Greece. Before Xerxes arrived, the Athenians evacuated their entire civilian population from Attica, a territory roughly the size of Rhode Island. The numbers involved are hard to estimate, but probably we should be thinking in terms of 100,000 or more. They included children, women, the elderly, foreigners, and probably slaves as well. Evacuations are always messy, as Christopher Nolan's recent movie Dunkirk shows us. But this one must have been especially messy. When the refugees arrived at their destination, there were no medical services, no reception centres, no aid workers, no supplies of clothing, bedding, or clean water to greet them. Most of them must have been evacuated from Attica by sea. The island of Salamis, which lies just 1 nautical mile south of Attica, was the principal destination. It meant the refugees would have had a ringside seat as the Persians burned Athens to the ground. But how did the Athenians evacuate tens of thousands? They had a fleet of warships known as triremes, but these would have been very unstable, laden with refugees. So I think they did what the Brits did back in 1940. They relied largely on the merchant fleet. This was one of the most challenging logistical undertakings ever mounted by an ancient society, and envisaging it can help us understand the nightmare scenario that refugees have always faced and always will.
That was Robert Garland of Colgate University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.